and the thud of the sea was muted. The powerful machine circled the courtyard, then came to a stop immediately in front of the main entrance. The rider removed his helmet, unstrapped a case from the pannier, and, carrying his helmet under his left arm, came bounding up the steps with the insouciance of a motorbike courier delivering a routine package. He said, "Mark Ayling. Body in the church, is it?" "Adam Dalgleish. Yes, it's this way. We'll go through the house and out by the south door. I've secured the door from the house into the north cloister." The hall was empty, and it seemed to Dalgleish that Dr. Ayling's feet rang unnaturally heavily on the tessellated floor. The pathologist could not be expected to sneak in, but this was hardly a tactful arrival. He wondered whether he ought to have found Father Sebastian and effected an introduction, but decided against it. This wasn't, after all, a social call, and the less delay the better. But he had no doubt that the pathologist's arrival had been noticed, and as they paced down the passageway past the cellar steps to the south cloister door, he had an uncomfortable, if irrational, feeling that he was guilty of a breach of good manners. To carry out a murder investigation in an atmosphere of barely suppressed non-cooperation and antagonism was, he reflected, less complicated than coping with the social and theological nuances of this present scene of crime. They crossed the courtyard beneath the half-denuded boughs of the great horse chestnut, and came to the sacristy door without speaking. As Dalgleish unlocked it, Ayling asked, "Where can I change my gear?" "In here. It's part vestry, part office." Changing gear apparently meant divesting himself of his leathers, putting on a brown three-quarter-length overall, and exchanging his boots for soft slippers, over which he drew white cotton socks. As he locked the sacristy door behind them, Dalgleish said, "It's likely that the murderer came in by this door. I'm securing the church until the Sarkars arrive from London." Ayling disposed of his leathers tidily on the swivel chair in front of the desk, and placed his boots neatly side by side. He asked, "Why the Met? It's a Suffolk case." "There's a Suffolk D.I. staying in college at present. It makes a complication. I was here on another matter, so it seems sensible for me to take over for the present." The explanation appeared to satisfy Ayling. They passed into the body of the church. The nave lights were dim, but sufficient, presumably, for a congregation who knew the liturgy by heart. They moved down to the doom. Dalgleish put up his hand to the spotlight. In the surrounding incense-laden gloom, which seemed, in imagination, to stretch beyond the church walls into an infinity of blackness, the beam blazed down with a shocking brilliance, brighter even than Dalgleish remembered. Perhaps, he thought, it was the presence of another person that transformed the scene into an act of grand guignol. The actor's carefully arranged body lying still with practiced art, the inspired touch of the two candlesticks placed at its head, himself, a silent watcher in the shadow of the pillar, waiting for his cue. Ayling, frozen momentarily into stillness by the unexpected glare, could have been assessing the effectiveness of the theatrical tableau. When he began his soft-footed prowl around the body, he looked like a director assessing the camera angles, satisfying himself that the death pose was both realistic and artistically pleasing. Dalgleish noticed details with greater clarity. The scuffed toe of the black leather slipper, which had fallen from Crampton's right foot, how large and peculiar the naked foot now seemed, how ugly and elongated the big toe. With the face partly invisible, that single foot, now forever stilled, assumed a potency greater than if the body had been naked, provoking an upsurge of both pity and outrage. Dalgleish had met Crampton only briefly, and had felt in his presence no more than a mild resentment at an unexpected and not particularly congenial guest. But now he felt as strong an anger as he had ever experienced at a murder scene. He found himself echoing words which were familiar, although their precise source eluded him. "Who hath done this thing?" he would discover the answer. And when he did, this time he would also find the proof. This time he would not close the file knowing the identity of the culprit, the motive and the means, but powerless to make an arrest. The burden of that past failure was still heavy upon him, but with this case it would at last be lifted. Ailing was still prowling cautiously round the body, never lifting his eyes from it, as if he had encountered some interesting but unusual phenomenon and was uncertain how it might react to scrutiny. Then he squatted by the head, sniffed delicately at the wound, and said, "Who is he?" "I'm sorry. I hadn't realized that you hadn't been told. Archdeacon Crampton. He's a recently appointed trustee of this college and arrived Saturday morning." "Someone didn't like him. Unless he surprised an intruder and this wasn't personal. Is there anything worth stealing?" "The altarpiece is valuable, but would be difficult to remove. There's no evidence that anyone has tried. There's valuable silver in the sacristy safe. The safe hasn't been tampered with." Ailing said, "And the candlesticks are still here. Brass, though hardly worth stealing. Not much doubt about the weapon or the cause of death. A blow to the right of the cranium above the ear, made by a heavy implement with a sharp edge. I don't know whether the first blow killed him, but it would certainly have felled him. And then the assailant struck again. Something like frenzy in the attack, I'd say." He straightened up, then lifted the unblooded candlestick with his gloved hand. "Heavy. It'd take some strength. A woman could do it, or an older man if they used both hands. Needed a bit of an eye, though, and he's not going to stand there with his back obligingly turned to a stranger, or to anyone he didn't trust, come to that. How did he get in? Crampton, I mean." Dalgleish realized that here he had a pathologist, not over-concerned about the precise extent of his responsibilities. "As far as I know, he hadn't a key. He was either let in by someone already here, or he found the door open. The doom has been vandalized. He could have been enticed in." "That looks like an inside job. Cuts down on the number of your suspects very conveniently. When was he found?" "At 5:30. I was here about 4 minutes later. Judging by the appearance of the blood and the beginning of rigor in the side of the face, I guessed that he'd been dead about 5 hours. "I'll take his temperature. But I doubt I can be more accurate. He died about midnight, give or take an hour." Dalgleish asked, "What about the blood? Would there have been much spurting?" "Not with the first blow. You know how it is with head wounds at this site. You get bleeding into the cranial cavity. But he didn't stick at one blow, did he? For the second and subsequent strikes, you'd get spurting. It could be more of a spatter than a strong stream. Depends how close he was to the victim when he struck the subsequent blows. If the assailant were right-handed, I'd expect the right arm to be bloodied, perhaps even the chest." He added, "You'd expect that, of course. Could have come in his shirt and rolled up his sleeves. Could have worn a T-shirt. Better still, been naked. It's been known." Dalgleish had heard nothing he hadn't thought out for himself. He said, "Wouldn't the victim have found that a little surprising?" Ailing ignored the interruption. "He'd have to be quick, though. He couldn't rely on the victim turning away from him for more than a second or two. Not much time to roll up a sleeve, get hold of a candlestick from where he'd placed it ready." "Where do you suppose that was?" "Inside the box pew. Bit too far, perhaps. Why not just stand it up behind the pillar? He'd only need to hide one stick, of course. He could fetch the other from the altar afterwards to set up his little tableau. I wonder why he bothered to do that. Somehow, I can't see it as an act of reverence." Finding Dalgleish unresponsive, he said, "I'll take his temperature and see if that helps fix the time of death, but I doubt whether I can put it closer than your original estimate. I'll be able to tell you more when I've had him on the table." Dalgleish didn't wait to watch this first violation of the body's privacy, but walked slowly up and down the central aisle until, looking back, he saw that Ailing had finished and had got to his feet. Together they returned to the sacristy. As the pathologist took off his working gown and zipped himself into his leathers, Dalgleish said, Would you care for some coffee? I dare say it could be arranged. No, thanks. Pressure of time, and they won't want to see me. I should be able to do the PM tomorrow morning, and I'll ring you, although I'm not expecting any surprises. The coroner will want the forensics done. He's careful like that. So will you, of course. I suppose I could use the Met Lab if Huntington is busy. You won't want him moved until the photographer and Sarkos have finished, but give me a ring when you're ready. I expect the people here will be glad to see the last of him. When Mark Ayling was ready to go, Dalgleish locked the sacristy door and reset the alarm. For some reason he found difficult to define, he was reluctant to take his companion through the house again. He said, "We can leave by the gate onto the headland. It'll save you being waylaid." They skirted the courtyard on the path of trodden grass. Across the scrubland, Dalgleish could see lights in the three occupied cottages. They looked like the lonely outposts of some beleaguered garrison. There was a light, too, in St. Matthew's cottage, and he guessed that Mrs. Pilbeam, probably with duster and vacuum cleaner, was making sure that it was clean and ready for occupation by the police. He thought again of Margaret Munro, and of that lonely dying which could have been so opportune, and there came to him a conviction that was as powerful as it was seemingly irrational, that the three deaths were connected. The apparent suicide, the certified natural death, the brutal murder. There was a cord which connected them. Its strength might be tenuous and its path convoluted, but when he had traced it, it would lead him to the heart of the mystery. In the front courtyard he waited until Ayling had mounted and roared away. He was turning to go back inside the house when he caught sight of the sidelights of a car. It had just turned from the approach road and was coming fast along the path. Within seconds, he had identified Piers Tarrant's Alfa Romeo. The first two members of his team had arrived. 8. The call came through to Detective Inspector Piers Tarrant at 6:15. Within 10 minutes, he was ready to leave. He had been instructed to call for Kate Miskin on the way, and reflected that this was unlikely to cause delay. Kate's flat on the Thames, just beyond Wapping, was on the route out of London he proposed to take. Detective Sergeant Robbins lived on the Essex border and would drive his own car to the scene. With luck, Piers hoped to overtake him. He let himself out of his flat and into the early Sunday morning quiet of the deserted streets. He collected his Alfa Romeo from the garage space, which was his by courtesy of the City of London Police, slung his murder bag in the back, and set off eastward on the same route along which Dalgleish had travelled 2 days before. Kate was waiting for him at the entrance to the block where she had a flat overlooking the river. He had never been invited inside, nor had she ever seen the interior of his flat in the city. The river, with its ever-changing light and shade, its dark surging tides and busy commercial life, was her passion as the city was his. His flat comprised only 3 rooms above a delicatessen in a back street near St. Paul's Cathedral. The camaraderie of the Met and his sexual life had no part in this private world. Nothing in the flat was superfluous, and everything was carefully chosen and as expensive as he could afford. The city, its churches and alleys, its cobbled passages and seldom visited courts, was both a hobby and a relief from his professional world. Like Kate, he was fascinated by the river, but as part of the city's life and history. He cycled each day to work and used his car only when he left London, but when he drove, it had to be a car he was happy to own. Kate buckled herself into the seat beside him after a brief greeting and for the first few miles didn't speak, but he could sense her excitement, as he knew she sensed his. He liked her and he respected her, but their professional relationship wasn't without its occasional small jags of resentment, irritation, or competition. But this was something they shared, this surge of adrenaline at the beginning of a murder inquiry. He had sometimes wondered whether this almost visceral thrill wasn't uncomfortably close to bloodlust. Certainly it held something of a blood sport. After they had left Docklands behind them, Kate said, "All right, put me in the picture. You read theology at Oxford, you must know something about this place." The fact that he had once read theology at Oxford was one of the few things about him she did know, and it had never ceased to intrigue her. Sometimes he could imagine that she believed he had gained some special insight or esoteric knowledge which gave him an advantage when it came to the consideration of motive and the infinite vicissitudes of the human heart. She would occasionally say, "What use is theology? Tell me that. You chose to spend 3 years on it. I mean, you must have felt you would gain something from it, and something useful or important." He doubted whether she had believed him when he said that choosing theology had given him a better chance of a place at Oxford than opting for the history which he would have preferred. He didn't tell her either what it was he had chiefly gained. A fascination with the complexity of the intellectual bastions which men could construct to withstand the tides of disbelief. His own disbelief had remained unshaken, but he had never regretted those 3 years. Now he said, "I know something about St. Anselm's, but not a lot. I had a friend who went on there after his degree, but we lost touch. I've seen photographs of the place. It's an immense Victorian mansion on one of the bleakest parts of the East Coast. There are a number of myths which have grown up around it. Like most myths, they're probably partly true. It's high church, prayer book Catholic maybe, I'm not really sure, with some fancy Roman additions. Strong on theology, opposed to practically everything that's happened in Anglicanism in the last 50 years, and you haven't a chance of getting in without a first-class degree. But I'm told the food is very good." Kate said, "I doubt we'll get the chance to eat it." "So it's elitist, the college." "You could say that, but then so is Manchester United." "Did you think of going there?" "No, because I didn't read theology with a view of going into the church. Anyway, they wouldn't have had me. I didn't get a good enough degree. The warden tends to be particular. He's an authority on Richard Hooker." "All right, don't ask. He was a 16th century divine. You can take it from me that anyone who has written the definitive work on Hooker is no intellectual slouch. We could have trouble with the Reverend Dr. Sebastian Morell." "And the victim? Did A.D. say anything about him?" "Only that he's an Archdeacon Crampton and was found dead in the church."
"And what's an archdeacon?"
"A kind of Rottweiler of the church. He, or it can be a she, looks after church property, inducts parish priests. Archdeacons have charge of a number of parishes and visit them once a year. The spiritual equivalent of Her Majesty's Inspector of Constabulary." Kate said, "So it's going to be one of those self-contained cases, with all the suspects under one roof, and us having to pussyfoot around to avoid private calls to the commissioner or complaints from the Archbishop of Canterbury. Why us, anyway?" "A.D. didn't talk for long. You know how he is. Anyway, he wanted us to get on the road. Apparently a D.I. from Suffolk was a visitor in the college last night. The chief constable apparently agrees that it would be inadvisable for them to take the case." Kate didn't question further, but Piers had the strong impression that she resented that he had taken the first call. She was, in fact, senior to him in terms of service, although she had never made an issue of it. He wondered whether he should point out that A.D. had saved time by ringing him first, since he had the faster car and would be driving, but decided against it. As he expected, they overtook Robbins on the Colchester bypass. Piers knew that had Kate been driving, they would have slackened speed to enable the team to arrive together. His response was to wave at Robbins and press down his foot on the accelerator. Kate had put her head back and appeared to be dozing. Glancing at the strong, good-looking face, he thought about their relationship. It had changed in the last 2 years, since the publication of the McPherson report. Although he knew little about her life, he did know that she was illegitimate and had been brought up by a grandmother in the bleakest of inner-city areas and at the top of a high-rise building.
Blacks had been her neighbors and her friends at school. To be told that she was a member of a force where racism was institutionalized had filled her with a passionate resentment, which she now realized had changed her whole attitude to her job. Politically far more sophisticated than she, and more cynical, he had tried to inject some calm into their heated discussions. She had demanded, "Given this report, would you join the Met if you were black?" "No, but nor would I if I were white. But I have joined, and I don't see why McPherson should drive me out of my job." He knew where he wanted that job to take him, to a senior post in the anti-terrorist branch. That was where the opportunities now lay. In the meantime, he was happy where he was, in a prestigious squad with a demanding boss he respected and enough excitement and variety to keep boredom at bay. Kate said, "Is that what they wanted, then? To discourage blacks from joining and drive out decent non-racist officers?" "For God's sake, Kate, let it rest. You're getting to be a bore. The report says that an act is racist if the victim perceives it as such. I perceive this report as racist. Racist against me as a white officer, so where do I go to complain?" "You could try the race relations people, but I doubt you'll get any joy. Speak to AD about it." He didn't know whether she had, but at least she was still in the job. He knew that he worked now with a different Kate. She was still conscientious, still hard-working, still dedicated to the task in hand. She would never let the team down. But something had gone. The belief that policing was a personal vocation as well as a public service, and that you owed it more than hard work and dedication. He used to find this personal commitment in her over-romantic and naive. Now he realized how much he missed it. At least, he told himself, the McPherson report had destroyed forever her over-deferential respect for the bench. By 8:30 they were passing through the village of Wrentham, still wrapped in an early morning calm, which seemed the more peaceful because hedges and trees showed the dilapidations of a night storm which had hardly touched London. Kate quickened into awareness to consult her map and watch for the Ballardsmere turning. Piers slackened speed. He said, "A.D. said it would be easy to miss. Look out for a large decaying ash on the right and a couple of flint cottages opposite." The ash, with its heavy cladding of ivy, was unmissable. But as they turned into the road, which was little more than a lane, one glance showed clearly what had happened. A large bough of the tree had been torn from the trunk and now lay along the grass verge, looking in the growing light as bleached and smooth as a bone. From it sprouted dead branches, like gnarled fingers. The main trunk showed the great wound where the branch had been torn away, and the road, now passable, was still strewn with the debris of the fall, curls of ivy, twigs, and a scatter of green and yellow leaves. There were lights in the windows of both cottages. Piers drew to the side and hooted. Within seconds, the figure of a stout middle-aged woman came down the garden path. She had a pleasant, wind-tanned face under an unruly bush of hair and wore a brightly flowered overall over what looked like layers of wool. Kate opened the window. Piers leaned across and said, "Good morning. You've had a spot of trouble here." "Come down she did at 10 o'clock, right on the hour. It was a storm, you see. A real blow we had last night. Lucky we heard the fall. Not that you could miss it for the noise she made. My husband was afraid there'd been an accident, so he put out red warning lights both sides. Then come morning, my Brian and Mr. Daniels from next door got the tractor and pulled her off the road. Not that many folk come this way except to visit the fathers and students at the college. Still, we thought better not to wait for the council to move it." Kate asked, "When did you clear the road, Mrs. Finch? Mrs. Finch?" "At 6:30. It was still dark, but Brian wanted to get it done before they was off to work." Kate said, "Lucky for us. It was very kind of you. Thank you. So, no one could have got past by car in either direction between 10 o'clock last night and 6:30 this morning?" "That's right, miss. There's only been a gentleman on a motorcycle, going to the college, no doubt. There's nowhere else to go on this road. He's not back yet. And no one else has driven past. Not that I saw, and I usually do see, the kitchen being at the front. They thanked her again, said their goodbyes, and moved off. Glancing back, Kate could see Mrs. Finch watching them for a few seconds, before relatching the gate and waddling off up the garden path. Pierce said, "One motorcycle, and he hasn't returned. Could have been the pathologist, although you'd expect him to come by car. Well, we've got some news for A.D., if this road is the only access." Kate had her eyes on the map. Which it is, for vehicles anyway. Then any murderer from outside the college must have arrived before 10 p.m. and can't yet have left. Not by road, anyway. An inside job? Pierce said. That's the impression I got from A.D. The question of access to the headland was so important that Kate was about to say that it was surprising A.D. hadn't already sent someone to question Mrs. Finch. But then she remembered. Until she and Piers arrived, who at St. Anselm's could he have sent? The narrow road was deserted. It was lower than the surrounding fields and edged with bushes, so that it was with a shock of surprise and pleasure that Kate saw suddenly the great crinkled greyness of the North Sea. To the north, a Victorian mansion bulked large against the sky. As they approached, Kate said, "Good Lord, what a monstrosity! Who would have thought of building a house like that literally within yards of the sea?" "No one. When it was built, it wouldn't have been within yards of the sea," she said. "You can't possibly admire it." "Oh, I don't know. It has a certain confidence." A motorcyclist was approaching and roared past. Kate said, "Presumably that was the forensic pathologist." Piers slowed down as they drove between two ruined pillars of red brick to where Dalgleish was waiting. 9. St. Matthew's Cottage would hardly have provided sufficient or suitable accommodation for a wide-spreading investigation, but Dalgleish judged that it was adequate for the task in hand. There was no suitable police accommodation within miles, and the bringing of caravans onto the headland would have been an illogical and expensive expedient. But being in college had its problems, including where they were to eat. In any human emergency or distress, from murder to bereavement, people still had to be fed and found beds. He recollected how, after his father's death, his mother's concern about how the Norfolk Rectory could accommodate all the overnight guests expected, their foibles about what they could or could not eat and what food should be provided for the whole of the parish, had blunted, at least temporarily, the edge of grief. Sergeant Robbins was already coping with present problems, telephoning a list of hotels suggested by Father Sebastian to book accommodation for himself, Kate, and Piers, and the three scene-of-crime officers. Dalgleish would remain in his guest set. The cottage was the most unusual incident room of his career. Mrs. Munro's sister, in removing every physical trace of occupation, had left the cottage so denuded of character that the very air was tasteless. The two small ground-floor rooms were furnished with obvious rejects from the guest sets, conventionally placed but producing only an atmosphere of dreary expedience. In the sitting room to the left of the door, a bentwood armchair with a faded patchwork cushion and a low slatted chair with a footrest had been placed on each side of the small Victorian grate. In the centre of the room was a square oak table with four chairs. Two others were set against the wall. A small bookcase to the left of the fireplace held only a leather-covered Bible and a copy of Through the Looking Glass. The right-hand room looked slightly more inviting, with a smaller table set against the wall, two mahogany chairs with bulbous legs, a shabby sofa, and a matching armchair. The two upstairs rooms were empty. Dalgleish judged that the sitting room could best serve as an office and for interviews, with the opposite room as a waiting room, while one of the bedrooms, fitted with a telephone socket and an adequate number of electric points, could house the computer which the Suffolk police had already provided. The question of food had been settled. Dalgleish balked at the thought of joining the community for dinner. His presence would, he thought, inhibit even Father Sebastian's conversational powers. The warden had extended an invitation, but had hardly expected it to be accepted. Dalgleish would take his evening meal elsewhere, but it had been agreed that the college would provide soup and sandwiches or a ploughman's lunch at 1 o'clock for all the team. The question of payment had been tactfully ignored for the present by both parties, but the situation was not without a touch of the bizarre. Dalgleish wondered whether this might prove to be the first murder case in which the killer had provided accommodation and free food for the investigating officer. They were anxious to get down to work, but first they must view the body. Dalgleish, Kate, Piers and Robbins went over to the church, put on overshoes, and made their way along the north wall to the doom. He could be sure that none of his officers would attempt to anesthetize horror by facetiousness or crude graveyard humor. Any who did so wouldn't serve under him for long. He switched on the spotlight, and they stood for a moment contemplating the body in silence. The quarry wasn't yet even a blurred figure on the horizon, and his spoor had not been detected, but this was his work in all its crude enormity, and it was right that they should see it. Only Kate spoke. She asked, "The candlestick, sir, where would they normally be?" "On the altar." "And when was the doom last seen unvandalized?" "At the 9:30 service of Compline yesterday evening." They locked the church behind them, set the alarm, and returned to the incident room. And now they settled down for the preliminary discussion and briefing before they got to work. Dalgleish knew that it couldn't be rushed. Information not given by him now, or imperfectly understood, could result in later delays, misunderstandings, or mistakes. He embarked on a detailed but concise account of everything he had seen or done since his arrival at St. Anselm's, including his investigation of Ronald Treves' death and the contents of Margaret Munro's diary. They sat together at the table, mostly in silence, making occasional notes. Kate sat upright, her eyes fixed on her notebook, except when, with disconcerting intensity, she raised them to Dalgleish's face. She was dressed as she always was when on a case, in comfortable walking shoes, narrowly cut trousers, and a well-tailored jacket. Beneath it in winter, as now, she wore a cashmere roll-neck jumper, in summer a silk shirt. Her light brown hair was drawn back and worn in a short, thick plait. She wore no discernible makeup, and her face, good-looking rather than handsome, expressed what essentially she was: honest, reliable, conscientious, but perhaps not wholly at peace with herself. Piers, restless as always, could not sit still for long. After several apparent attempts at comfort, he now sat with his legs wound round those of the chair and his arm flung round the back. But his mobile, slightly podgy face was alight with interest, and the sleepy, chocolate-brown eyes under the heavy lids held their usual look of quizzical amusement. Less obviously attentive than Kate, he still missed nothing. He was informally dressed in a green linen shirt with fawn linen trousers, an expensively creased informality which was as carefully considered as Kate's more conventional look. Robbins, as neat and formal as a chauffeur, sat perfectly at ease at the end of a table and got up from time to time to brew more coffee and refill their mugs. When Dalgleish had finished his account, Kate said, "What are we going to call this murderer, sir?" Rejecting the usual sobriquets, the squad invariably chose a name at the beginning of the investigation. Piers said, "Cain would be appropriately biblical and short, if hardly original." Dalgleish said, "Cain it is. Now we get down to work. I want prints from everyone who was in college last night, including visitors and the staff in the cottages. The Archdeacon's prints can await the arrival of the Sockers. You'd better make the others a priority before we make a start on the interviews. Then examine the clothes all the residents were wearing yesterday, and that includes the priests. I've checked the Ordnance brown cloaks. The right number are in place and look clean, but take another look. Pierre said.
He had hardly have worn either a cloak or a cassock, surely, why should he? If Crampton was enticed into the church, he'd expect to find the caller waiting for him in his nightclothes, pyjamas or a dressing gown. Then the blow must have been struck very quickly, seizing the moment when Crampton turned towards the doom. Time, maybe, to roll up a pyjama sleeve. He'd hardly encumber himself with a heavy serge cloak. Of course, he could have been naked, or partly naked, under a dressing gown and slipped it off. Even so, he'd have to be damn quick.
Dalglish said, "The pathologist made the not particularly original suggestion that he was naked."
Piers went on. "It's not all that fanciful, sir. After all, why show himself at all to Crampton? All he needs to do is to unbolt the south door and leave it ajar. Then he puts on the light to illuminate the doom and hides behind a pillar. Crampton might be surprised to find no one waiting for him, but he'd go over to the doom anyway, drawn to it by the light, and because the caller had told him that it had been vandalized, and exactly how."
Kate said, "Wouldn't he ring Father Sebastian before he went to the church?"
"Not till he'd seen for himself. He wouldn't want to make a fool of himself by raising the alarm unnecessarily. But I wonder what excuse the caller gave him to explain being in the church at that hour.
A chink of light, perhaps?
He was woken by the wind, looked out, saw a figure, and got suspicious. But the question probably wasn't even raised. Crampton's first thought would have been to go to the church."
Kate said, "And if Cain had worn a cloak, why return to the house and still retain the keys?
The missing keys are the vital piece of evidence. The murderer couldn't risk having them in his possession. They'd be easy enough to dispose of, chuck them anywhere on the headland. But why not return them? If he'd had the guts to sneak in and take them, you'd think he'd have the guts to go back and return them."
Pierce said, "Not if he was bloodstained, either his hands or his clothes."
"But why should he be? We've gone over all that. And there's no hurry. He would have time to go back to his room and wash. He wouldn't expect the body to be discovered until the church was opened for morning prayer at 7:15.
"There's one thing, though."
"Yes?" asked Dalglish.
"Doesn't the fact that the keys weren't returned point to the murderer being someone who lives outside the house? Any of the fathers had a legitimate reason for being there at any hour of the day or night. There would be no risk to them in returning the keys."
Dalglish said, "You're forgetting, Kate. They wouldn't need to take them. The four priests already have keys, and I've checked. They're still on their key rings."
Piers said, "But one of them might take a set precisely in order to throw suspicion on one of the staff, ordnance or guests."
Dalglish said, "It's a possibility, just as it's a possibility that the defacing of the doom had nothing to do with the murder. There's a childish malice about it which doesn't tie up with the brutality of the killing. But the most extraordinary thing about this murder is why it was done in this way. If someone wanted Crampton dead, he could have been killed without any need to entice him into the church. None of the guest sets has a lock or key to the door. Anyone in college could have walked into Crampton's room and killed him in his bed.
Even an outsider wouldn't have had much difficulty, provided he knew the layout of the college. An ornamental iron gate is one of the easiest to climb over."
Kate said, "But we know he can't have been an outsider, apart from the missing keys. No car could have got past that fallen branch after 10 o'clock. I suppose Cain could have come on foot, climbed over the tree, or maybe walked along the beach. It wouldn't have been easy in last night's wind."
Dalglish said, "The murderer knew where to find the keys and the code for the alarm. It looks like an inside job, but we keep an open mind. I'm just pointing out that if the murder had been committed in a less spectacular and bizarre way, it would have been difficult to bring it home to anyone at St. Anselm's. The possibility would always have remained that someone did get in, perhaps a casual thief, who got to know that doors were unlocked and killed Crampton in a panic because he woke at the wrong moment. It isn't likely, but it couldn't have been discounted. This murderer not only wanted Crampton dead, he wanted the crime fixed firmly in St. Anselm's. Once we've discovered why, we'll be on the way to solving it."
Sergeant Robbins had been sitting quietly a little apart, making notes. Two of his many accomplishments were the ability to work unobtrusively and to write shorthand. But his memory was so reliable and precise that the notes were hardly necessary. Although the most junior, he was a member of the team, and Kate found herself waiting for Dalglish to bring him in.
Now, he said. Any theory, Sergeant?
Not really, sir. It's almost certainly an inside job, and whoever did it is perfectly happy for us to know that. But I'm wondering whether the altar candlestick could be part of that. Can we be certain it was the weapon? Okay, it's bloody, but it could have been taken from the altar and used after Crampton was dead. The PM wouldn't be able to show, not conclusively anyway, whether the first blow was struck with the candlestick, only whether there are traces on it of Crampton's blood and brain.
Pierce said, "What's your thinking? Isn't the central puzzle the difference between an obviously premeditated murder and the frenzy of the attack?"
"Let's suppose it wasn't premeditated. We're fairly sure that Crampton must have been lured there, presumably to be shown the desecration of the tomb. Someone is waiting for him. And then there's an angry exchange. Kane loses control and strikes out. Crampton falls. Then Kane, standing over a dead man, sees a way of pinning it on the college. He takes the two candlesticks, uses one to strike Crampton again, and sets both of them up at his head."
Kate said, "It's possible, but that would mean that Kane had something ready to hand, something heavy enough to crack a skull."
Robbins went on, "It could be a hammer, any sort of heavy tool, a garden implement. Suppose he saw the gleam of a light in the church last night, and went to investigate, arming himself with anything he had handy. Then he finds Crampton there. They have a violent quarrel, and he strikes out."
Kate objected. "But why would anyone go into the church at night alone, armed with any kind of a weapon? Why not ring someone in the house?"
"He might prefer to investigate, and perhaps he didn't go alone. Perhaps he had someone with him."
"A sister, maybe," thought Kate. It was an interesting theory. Dalglish was for a moment silent. Then he said, "We've a lot to do between the four of us. I suggest we get started." He paused, wondering whether to speak what was in his mind. They had one murder clear before them. He didn't want to complicate the investigation with matters which might not be relevant. On the other hand, it was important that his suspicion should be kept in mind.
He said, "I think we have to see this murder in the context of two previous deaths, Treves and Mrs. Munro. I have a hunch, no more at this stage, that they're connected. The link may be fragile, but I think it's there."
The suggestion was greeted by a few seconds of silence. He felt their surprise. Then Piers said, "I thought you were more or less satisfied, sir, that Treves killed himself. If Treves was murdered, it would be too much of a coincidence to have two killers in St. Anselm's. But surely Treves' death was either suicide or an accident. Look at the facts as you've set them out. The body was found 200 yards from the only access to the beach. Difficult to carry him over that shore, and he'd hardly walk willingly with his killer. He was strong and healthy. You couldn't bring down half a ton of sand on his head unless you'd first drugged him, made him drunk, or knocked him out. None of these things happened. You said the PM was thorough."
Kate spoke directly to Piers.
"Okay, let's accept it was suicide. But suicide has to have a reason. What drove him to it? Or who? There could be a motive there."
"But not for Crampton's murder, surely. He wasn't even at St. Anselm's at the time. We have no reason to suppose he ever met Treves."
Kate went doggedly on. "Mrs. Munro remembered something from her past which worried her. She speaks to the person concerned, and shortly afterwards she's dead. It strikes me that her death is suspiciously convenient."
"For whom, for God's sake? She had a bad heart. She could have died any time."
Kate reiterated. "She wrote that diary entry. There was something she remembered, something she knew. And she would have been the easiest person of all to kill, an elderly woman with a weak heart, particularly if she had no reason to fear her killer."
Piers protested.
Okay, she knew something. That doesn't mean it was important. It could have been some minor peccadillo, something Father Sebastian and those priests wouldn't approve of, but which no one else would take seriously. And now she's cremated, this cottage cleared, and the evidence, if any, gone for good. Whatever she remembered, it happened 12 years ago anyway. Who's going to do murder for that? Kate said, "She found Treves' body, remember?" "What's that to do with it? The diary note is explicit. She didn't remember that incident from her past when she saw the body. She remembered when Surtees brought her some leeks from his garden. It was then that things came together, the present and the past." Kate said, "Leeks? A leek. Could it be a play on the word?" "For God's sake, Kate, that's pure Agatha Christie." Piers turned to Dalgliesh. "Are you saying, sir, that we are now investigating two murders, Crampton's and Mrs. Munro's?" "No. I'm not proposing to jeopardize a murder inquiry for the sake of a hunch. What I am saying is that there could be a connection, and that we should keep it in mind. There's a lot to do, so we'd better get on with it. The priority is the fingerprinting and questioning the priests and ordinance. That's for you, Kate, with Piers. They've seen enough of me. So has Surtees. So you'd better see him and his sister. There's an advantage in facing them with someone new. We're not going to get far until Inspector Yarwood is well enough to be questioned. According to the hospital, that should be by Tuesday, if we're lucky." Piers said, "If there's a chance he might have a vital clue, or if he's a suspect, shouldn't he be kept unobtrusively under guard?" Dalgliesh said, "He is being kept unobtrusively under guard. Suffolk are helping there. He was out of his room that night. He could even have seen the murderer. That's why I'm not leaving him without protection." There was the sound of a car bumping across the headland. Sergeant Robbins went to the window. "Mr. Clark and the Sockers have arrived, sir." Piers looked at his watch. "Not bad, but they'd have been better driving the whole way. It's getting out of Ipswich that takes the time. Lucky the train didn't foul up." Dalgliesh said to Robbins, "Ask them to bring their gear in here. They can use the second bedroom, and they'll probably want coffee before they start." "Yes, sir." Dalgliesh decided that the scene of crime officers could change into their search clothes in the church, but well away from the actual scene. Brian Clark, the head of the team and inevitably called Nobby, hadn't worked with Dalgliesh before. Calm, unemotional, and humorless, he was not the most inspiring of colleagues. But he came with a reputation for thoroughness and reliability, and, when he did condescend to communicate, spoke sense. If there was anything to find, he would find it. He was a man who distrusted enthusiasm, and even the most potentially valuable clue was apt to be greeted with, "All right, lads, keep calm. It's only a palm print. It's not the Holy Grail." He also believed in the separation of functions. His job was to discover, collect, and preserve the evidence, not to usurp the job of the detective. For Dalgliesh, who encouraged teamwork and was receptive to ideas, this reserve amounting to taciturnity was a disadvantage. Now, and not for the first time, he missed Charlie Ferris, the Socco who had been on the job when he had investigated the Barone Harry Mack murders. They too had taken place in a church. He could clearly recall Ferris, small, sandy-haired, sharp-featured and lithe as a greyhound, prancing gently like an eager runner awaiting the starting pistol. Recall, too, the extraordinary working garb which the ferret had devised for the job. The diminutive white shorts and short-sleeved sweatshirt, the tight-fitting plastic cap which made him look like a swimmer who had forgotten to take off his underclothes. But the ferret had retired to run a pub in Somerset, where his orotund bass, so incongruous in his slight frame, was adding power to the village church choir. A different pathologist, a different team of Soccos, soon to have their name changed again. He supposed that he was lucky still to have Kate Miskin, but now was not the time to concern himself with Kate's morale or with her possible future. Perhaps, he thought, it was increasing age which made him less tolerant of change. but at least the photographer was familiar. Barney Parker was past retirement age and now worked on a part-time basis. He was a voluble, wiry, eager-eyed, jaunty little man who had looked exactly the same for all the years Dalgleish had known him. His other part-time job was taking wedding photographs, and perhaps this soft-focus beautifying of brides provided a relief from the uncompromising starkness of his police work. He had, indeed, something of the irritating importunity of a wedding photographer looking round at the scene as if to ensure that there were no other bodies anxious for his attention. Dalgleish almost expected him to chivy them all for the family lineup, but he was an excellent photographer whose work couldn't be faulted. Dalgleish walked over to the church with them, passing through the sacristy and skirting the murder scene. They changed in a pew near the south door in a silence which Dalgleish judged had nothing to do with the sacredness of the scene, and stood like a little group of spacemen in their white cotton oversuits and hoods, watching Nobby Clark follow Dalgleish back towards the sacristy. With the hood of his suit puckered round his face and his slightly protruding upper teeth, Dalgleish thought that Clark needed only a pair of ears to make him look like a large, disgruntled rabbit. Dalgleish said, "The murderer almost certainly came in through the sacristy door from the north cloister. That means the cloister floor will need examining for prints, although I doubt you'll get anything useful under this weight of leaves. No knob on the door, but the prints of almost everyone here could validly be on any part of the door." Moving into the church, he said, "There's a possibility of prints on the doom and on the wall beside it, although he would have been crazy not to wear gloves. This candlestick on the right has traces of blood and hair, but again we'll be lucky to get prints. What is interesting is here." He led the way up the central aisle to the second box pew. "Someone has hidden himself under the seat. There's a considerable amount of dust which has been disturbed. I don't know whether you'll get prints on the wood, but it's a possibility." Clark said, "Right, sir. What about the team's lunch? There doesn't seem to be a pub near, and I don't want to break off. I'd like as much natural light as possible." "The college is providing sandwiches. Robbins will be fixing beds for the night. We can look at progress tomorrow." "I think I'll need more than 2 days, sir. It's those leaves in the north cloister. They'll all need shifting and examining." Dalgleish doubted whether any joy would result from this tedious exercise, but had no wish to discourage Clark's obvious attention to detail. He said a last word to the other two members of the team and left them to it. Ten. Before the individual interviews began, the fingerprinting of everyone at St. Anselm's had priority. The task fell to Piers and Kate. Both knew that Dalgleish preferred all women to be fingerprinted by a member of their own sex. Before they began, Piers said, "It's a long time since I've done this. You better see to the women as usual. Seems an unnecessary refinement to me. Anyone would think it was a form of rape." Kate was making the preparations. She said, "You could see it as a form of rape, innocent or not innocent. I'd hate to have some police officer grabbing hold of my fingers." "It's hardly a grab. Looks as if we've got a full waiting room except for the priests. Who do we start with?" "Better make it a buthnot." Kate was interested in the different reactions of the suspects who presented themselves during the next hour with varying degrees of meekness. Father Sebastian, arriving with his fellow priests, was grimly cooperative, but could not resist a moo of distaste when Piers took his fingers to cleanse them in soap and water, then firmly rolled them on the ink pad. He said, "Surely I can do it for myself." Piers was unconcerned. "I'm sorry, sir. It's a question of making sure we get a good print at the edges. A matter of experience, really." Father John didn't speak from start to finish, but his face was deathly white, and Kate saw that he was shaking. Throughout the brief procedure, he kept his eyes closed. Father Martin was frankly interested and gazed with almost childish wonder at the complicated pattern of whorls and loops which proclaimed his unique identity. Father Peregrine, his eyes straining towards the college, to which he was impatient to return, seemed hardly aware of what was happening. Only when he caught sight of his ink-smeared fingers was he provoked to grumble that he hoped the stain would be easily washed off, and that ordnance should ensure that their fingers were thoroughly clean before coming to the library. He would put up a note on the board. None of the ordnance or staff made any difficulty, but Stannard came prepared to see the procedure as a gross infringement of civil liberty. He said, "I suppose you have authority for doing this?" Piers said calmly, "Yes, sir, with your consent, under the provisions of the Police and Criminal Evidence Act. I think you know the legislation." "And if I didn't consent, I've no doubt you could get some kind of court order. After you've made an arrest, if you ever get that far, and I'm proved innocent, I take it my prints will be destroyed. How can I be sure they will?" "You have the right to witness the destruction if you make an application." "And I will," he said, as his fingers were placed on the ink pad. "You can be bloody sure I will." Now they had finished, and the last to be fingerprinted, Emma Lavenham, had left. Kate said, with such careful casualness that even she found her tone unnatural, "What do you suppose A.D. thinks about her?" "He's a heterosexual male and a poet. He thinks what any heterosexual male and poet thinks when he meets a beautiful woman. What I think, come to that, he'd like to take it to the nearest bed." "Oh, come on. Do you have to be that crude? Can't any of you think of a woman except in terms of bed?" "What a Puritan you are, Kate. You asked me what he'd think, not what he'd do. He has all his instincts under control. That's his trouble." "She's an anomaly here, isn't she? Why do you think Father Sebastian imported her?" "To provide a temporary exercise in resisting temptation. You'd think a pretty boy would be a better bet. The four we've met so far, though, seem a depressingly hetero bunch to me. And you'd know, of course." "So would you. Talking of beauty, what do you think of the Adonis Raphael? The name's too appropriate, isn't it? I wonder whether he'd look the same if he'd been christened Albert. Too good-looking, and he knows it." "Turn you on?" "No. And nor do you. Time to make some visits. Who should we start with? Father Sebastian?" "At the top. Why not? And after that, A.D. wants me with him when he interviews Arbuthnot. Who'll take the lead with the warden?" "Me. To begin with, anyway." "You think he'll open up more to a woman?" "You may be right, but I shouldn't bank on it. These priests are used to the confessional. That makes them good at keeping secrets, including their own."
11. Father Sebastian had said, "You will, of course, wish to see Mrs. Crampton before she leaves. I'll send you a message when she's ready. If she should want to visit the church, I assume that would be permissible?" Dalgleish replied briefly that it would. He wondered whether Father Sebastian had taken it for granted that if Mrs. Crampton wished to see where her husband had died, he would be the one to escort her. Dalgleish had other ideas, but judged that now was not the time to argue the point. Mrs. Crampton might not wish to visit the church. Whether she did or not, it was important that they meet. The message that she was ready to see him was brought to the incident room by Stephen Morby, who was now being used by Father Sebastian as a general messenger. Dalgleish had noticed how much Morell disliked the telephone. When he entered the warden's office, Mrs. Crampton got up from her chair and came towards him, holding out her hand and regarding him steadily. She was younger than Dalgleish had expected, heavily breasted above a neat waist, and with a pleasant, open and unadorned face. She was hatless, and her short mid-brown hair, brushed to shininess, looked expensively cut. He could almost believe she had come straight from the hairdresser, if the idea were not preposterous. She was wearing a tweed suit in blue and fawn, with a large cameo brooch in the lapel. It was obviously modern and looked incongruous against the country tweed. Dalgleish wondered whether it had been a gift from her husband, and she had fastened it in her jacket as a badge of allegiance or defiance.
A short travelling coat lay across the back of a chair. She was perfectly calm, and the hand which clasped Dalgliesh's was cold but firm. Father Sebastian's introduction was brief and formal. Dalgliesh said the customary words of sympathy and regret. He had spoken them to the family of a murder victim more times than he could remember. To him they always sounded insincere. Father Sebastian said, "Mrs. Crampton would like to visit the church, and has asked that you go with her. If I'm needed, you'll find me here." They walked together through the south cloister and across the cobbles of the courtyard to the church. The archdeacon's body had been removed, but Sokos were still busy in the building, and one of them was now clearing the leaves from the north cloister, carefully examining each one. There was already a clear path to the sacristy door. The church struck cold, and Dalgliesh was aware that his companion shivered. He asked, "Would you like me to fetch your coat?" "No, thank you, Commander. I shall be all right." He led the way to the doom. It was not necessary to tell her that this was the place. The stones were still stained with her husband's blood. Unself-consciously and a little stiffly she knelt. Dalgliesh moved away and walked up the central aisle. Within a few minutes she had joined him. She said, "Shall we sit down for a little while? I expect you have some questions you want to ask." "I could ask them in Father Sebastian's office, or in the incident room in St. Matthew's cottage, if that would be more comfortable for you." "I shall be more comfortable here." The two Sokos had moved tactfully into the sacristy. They sat for a brief moment in silence. Then she said, "How did my husband die, Commander?" Father Sebastian seemed reluctant to say. "Father Sebastian hasn't been told, Mrs. Crampton." Which didn't, of course, mean he didn't know. Dalgliesh wondered whether this possibility had occurred to her. He said, "It's important for the success of the investigation that the details be kept secret for the present." "I understand that. I shall say nothing." Dalgliesh said gently, "The archdeacon was killed by a blow to the head. It would have been very sudden. I don't think he suffered. He may not even have had time to feel shock or fear." "Thank you, Commander." Again there was a silence. It was curiously companionable, and he was in no hurry to break it. Even in her grief, which she was bearing with stoicism, she was restful to be with. Was it this quality, he wondered, which had drawn the archdeacon to her? The silence lengthened. Glancing at her face, he saw the glister of a tear on her cheek. She put up a hand to brush it away, but when she spoke, her voice was steady. "My husband was not welcome in this place, Commander, but I know that no one at St. Anselm's could possibly have killed him. I refuse to believe that a member of a Christian community could be capable of such evil." Dalgliesh said, "This is a question I have to ask. Had your husband any enemies, anyone who might wish him harm?" "No. He was much respected in the parish. One might say that he was loved, although it wasn't a word he would have used. He was a good, compassionate, and conscientious parish priest, and he never spared himself. I don't know whether anyone has told you that he was a widower when we married. His first wife committed suicide. She was a very beautiful but disturbed woman, and he was greatly in love with her. The tragedy affected him deeply, but he had come through it. He was learning how to be happy. We were happy together. It's cruel that all his hopes should come to this." Dalgliesh said, "You said that he wasn't welcome at St. Anselm's. Was this because of theological differences, or were there other reasons? Did he discuss his visit here with you?" "He discussed everything with me, Commander. Everything that hadn't been told him in confidence as a clergyman. He felt that St. Anselm's had outgrown its usefulness." "He wasn't the only one who felt that. I think even Father Sebastian realizes that the college is an anomaly and will have to close. There were differences of churchmanship, of course, which didn't make things any easier. And then I expect you know about the problem of Father John Betterton." Dalgliesh said carefully. I gained the impression that there was a problem, but I don't know the details. It's an old and rather tragic story. Some years ago, Father Betterton was found guilty of sexual offences against some of his choir boys and was sentenced to prison. My husband uncovered part of the evidence and was a witness at the trial. We weren't married at the time. It was shortly after his first wife's death, but I know it caused him much distress. He did what he saw as his duty, and it caused him a great deal of pain. Dalgliesh privately thought that the greater pain had been suffered by Father John. He said, "Did your husband say anything to you before coming on this visit? Anything to suggest that he might have arranged to meet someone here, or that he had reason to suppose that this visit would be particularly difficult?" "No, nothing. I'm sure no meeting was arranged other than with the people here. He wasn't looking forward to the weekend, but he wasn't dreading it either." "And had he been in touch with you since he arrived yesterday?" "No, he hadn't telephoned, and I wouldn't have expected him to. The only call I had, apart from parish business, was from the diocesan office. Apparently they had lost my husband's mobile phone number and wanted it for the records." "What time was this call?" "Quite late. I was surprised because it must have been after the office was closed. It was just before 9:30 on Saturday." "Did you speak to the person who rang? Was it a man or a woman?" "It sounded like a man. I thought at the time that it was a man, although I couldn't swear to it. No, I didn't really speak except to give the number. He just said thank you and rang off at once." "Of course he did," thought Dalgliesh. "He wouldn't want to speak an unnecessary word. All he wanted was the number he could get in no other way. The number he would ring that night from the church to summon the archdeacon to his death. Wasn't this the answer to one of the problems at the heart of the case? If Crampton had been lured to the church by a call on his mobile, how had the caller discovered the number? It wouldn't be difficult to trace that 9:30 call, and the result could be damning for someone at St. Anselm's. But there still remained a mystery. The murderer, better still, think of him as Cain, wasn't unintelligent. This crime had been carefully planned. Wouldn't Cain have expected Dalgliesh to speak to Mrs. Crampton? Wasn't it possible